Welcome to For Love and Music with Tara Joseph, as she explores the ever-changing music industry with today's top creatives, artists, and executives. Enjoy these fun and informative conversations with a little bit of love thrown in along the way.
Welcome to For Love and Music with me, Tara Joseph.
Our guest today is one of the most respected execs in the music industry. We originally met when he was VP of International Artist Development at Warner Brothers Records. And now he runs his own successful business, Over the Top Global, working with some of the biggest artists on the planet. So let's give a very, very warm welcome to my dear friend, Dion Singer. Dion, how are you?
How are you? I'm so happy to talk to you. I was so excited when I heard that you were doing the podcast and we connected and got to talk and we had so much fun together.
Yeah, no, we absolutely really? Did, didn't we, back in the day. And I was so, it was really because of the podcast, I think, that we did reconnect, right? Because of LinkedIn.
That's right. So, and now we're going to be doing all kinds of exciting things together and we're going to find the next star if it kills us both.
Well, absolutely. I look forward to that. I really, really do. So tell us, where are you right now?
So I'm at my home in LA in my little office. I always wanted, when I lived in London, I never had space for any books. So I thought when I finally got my place in LA, I was like, finally, I'm going to get a wall of books. And why buy one when you can buy more? And I collect books and I collect records. So I've sort of used my house as my home office. So if anybody wants to talk to me about music or if any musician wants to talk to me about a project, there's an idea that we can steal from somewhere behind me.
And you know what? The listeners can't see what I can see, but there is a magnificent array of books behind Dion. So it's absolutely true what he's saying.
You know, it's one of the things that I've learned is that if you, it's the old Quincy Jones thing, if you know the history in every which way you can about music, and I try and learn as much and study as much as I can. If somebody has an idea, oh, what about this? What about this? It just helps you get context about all kinds of crazy ideas that you can find to market your music and get your message out there.
Absolutely. So let's go back to the beginning. So you are from a town near Johannesburg in South Africa.
A little town called Benoni. It's actually where Charlize Theron is from.
Oh, really? I love Charlize Theron.
She's amazing. I used to take music lessons down the road. Well, she's much younger than me, but I know exactly where she used to live.
She's amazing.
She's amazing. A lovely, lovely, amazing person. And you'd asked me for some background, and I said to you, apartheid South Africa, it was insane. It was just the craziest time to grow up. When I was about 8 or 9, my parents bought me an electronic organ. Nobody knew anything. Nobody said, oh, put him on a piano. I'm getting an organ. So off I go for organ lessons. And that was how I kind of got into music.
Do you still play the organ?
Oh, absolutely. I've got pianos and synthesizers and all the time. And I'm terrible at it.
But do you need to invite us round for a music night?
Absolutely. And this is what I have here. It's fine. Well, Maxwell, who you know I work with, we've had so many sessions here with artists and put chairs in the front room and play the piano and listen to a bunch of kids sing and talk to them and try and teach them and help them. It's
great fun. I'd love to come and see you do your thing on the organ.
It's great fun.
So you mentioned about apartheid, and I actually didn't know that television was not allowed in South Africa until 1976.
Yeah, I mean, television, the apartheid government knew that once people started to see television, people would start to ask questions. I think they also probably realized what a great propaganda tool it could be. So I literally remember television starting. It wasn't black and white to color, it was color. And it was very tightly controlled, and Afrikaans on one night and English on another night, and sort of 6 till 10 or something. It was crazy. But I also think it was very interesting how South Africa actually went through a peaceful transition. And I had a history teacher at school who was from the UK, and she always said to me, it was because of these particular programs, which had taught people things that they didn't know. It really was censored and insane. You don't even realize it until afterwards you look back at it and you go, what?
Yeah. Well, what a place to grow up. And as a young boy with sort of musical aspirations, how did you go from playing the organ to sort of moving on up actually into the international music scene? How did that happen?
Well, I was very fortunate in that my parents didn't have a lot of money, but they always found money for music. It was always, they sent me off for music lessons. I was just crazy about music. All I did was play the keyboards and the synthesizers and all kinds of things. And I must have landed up one day at a music shop, like a musical instrument shop, and asked if I could play the big massive organ. And it was obviously a kind of a spectacle of this little chubby kid playing this crazy instrument and, you know, how to get the customers in the stores. So from about 12 or 13, certain things happened in my life and things changed. And the next thing, I had a job in the music store. And I literally spent my life growing up in these two stores, which sold sheet music and music books and guitars and flutes and pianos. And that was where I met everybody. What an education.
So from working in these music stores where you must have learned so much, how did your break into actually becoming an exec happen?
So, of course, as Jewish mom, was like, you need something to fall back on. I don't know if there's money to be made in the music business. And she wasn't wrong, because when you're standing there, I was thinking about it yesterday in preparation for talking to you. I remember musicians would come in and say, I can't afford to buy all the guitar strings. Can I just buy one string? So I sort of looked around and I thought, okay, you can't make money as a musician. You're probably not that good enough. So off you go to business school. So I studied finance and accounting, which I couldn't bear, but I did it. And I went to university, going to become a chartered accountant. And then probably as I was finishing my last year of university, the music store was closing down. There was just no money. Your music was such a luxury item in South Africa, and nobody was buying music books. They would come in and they'd go, oh, can I have Georgia on my mind? And say, oh, it's in this book, you know, easy listening hits of the 40s. So can't I just photocopy it? No, you can't photocopy it. You know, it was so crazy. So you sort of just watched the business get smaller and smaller. And at some point, the owner, who was a magnificent human being, said to me, you need to find a job somewhere else because there's no future here. So the biggest independent is Gallo Africa. And somebody got me in there and I just drove them crazy.
That's what you got to do, isn't it? Seriously.
I literally, a friend of mine who was a music journalist, got me in to meet somebody and she said, oh, I don't have anything for you, but there's a job board somewhere. So she took me somewhere in the building to the job board. And I remember they were looking for a royalty clerk, they were looking for a tea lady, and they were looking for a salesman. And I took off all three and I said, I can do any three of these, no problem. And eventually the woman said to me, if we give you an interview, will you stop calling? And I said, sure. And then I got the interview and I went in for the sales job. And the sales job was Gallo Music Productions, which was the traditional black music division of Gallo. There were 12 or 15 people. They sold Bakanga Music, traditional Soul Brothers, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, the band from Paul Simon's record. That was Gallo, Miriam Makeba, Western Corsi, Mahotella Queens. And the guy was like, Dion, you can't be selling traditional Zulu music driving around Johannesburg. And he sent me to see the financial accountant who gave me a job. And that was how I kind of landed up in the accounting department. And after a couple of weeks, I said to my boss, yeah, I know I'm in the accounting department, but I really want to be in music. And he was like, oh God, another one, you know? But it was amazing because they let you get involved in anything and everything.
So that was really your segue into then joining Warner's.
That's right. So, you know, Gallo, after apartheid, all the companies that Gallo had had licenses with came back into South Africa. Sony, I mean, EMI were always there, but Sony and PolyGram and Universal and BMG and all of the companies came back. So Gallo was this huge, huge, huge company with a very small domestic roster and independent labels. So after a few years of working, they acquired the Warner license. So for probably 8 years where I worked down there, that was how I got to know the world of Warner. Not as a Warner employee, but as a Warner licensee, which is very interesting.
So when you started to get to know Warner and eventually you were given the opportunity to join Warner Brothers Records and you moved to the UK, what was that like? Because obviously it must have been a completely different, I mean, it is a completely different culture. And all of a sudden you found yourself working with the likes of Madonna and Green Day and Cher and other such huge stars.
It was, I mean, I'd never seen anything. I mean, I can't even explain. On the one hand, it was landing on another planet. But on the other side is that when you've learned in a record company how to make money out of nothing, where you have nothing to sell this Christmas but a couple of indie singles and the greatest classical hits of all time on piano, two CDs for the price of one, and all that kind of nonsense. The boss said to me, your job is you pick up the phone and whoever's on the other end of the phone, you say, what can I do to help you sell albums and singles? That's your job. But because I'd been doing it in a country, I was like, oh, I understand. Okay, yes, no, you're right. No problem. You need an extra track. You need to change the cover. You need a different single for Germany. You need a different cover for Japan. You know, it was like, what do we need to do to help you break this act? And the guy who brought me was a guy called Jay Durgan, who was very, very, very seasoned, very, very smart guy. And the funny thing is that because I'd been doing it in South Africa, I sort of knew what the people needed. You know, as an example, you know, I'm sorry, I knew what you needed to break an artist in South Africa. So why would it be different in Germany or Australia or Ireland or Canada?
So obviously you were breaking artists and you were working, as I mentioned earlier, with huge artists.
Yeah.
And when you originally as VP of International, weren't you? Because you were VP of International before you were VP of Creative.
Yes.
So explain what that means then to the listeners. So as VP of International, you were working with the artists who were overseas, who were releasing in the UK?
Correct. Anything that was coming from America, I did various things. You would think about it this way. It's like sitting in the traffic tower of an airport and the artists are coming on planes and you're sending them. You're working out strategically what's the best thing that we can do. Oh, okay, so you have a television show for this kind of artist. You have something in Italy. Okay, can we find something in Spain? What about something in France? And you sort of put these things together. You help everybody and you strategically sit and you plan out where to go and how you go from market to market, basically breaking an artist.
And what was it like working with a Madonna, for example?
It spoiled me terribly. And it's probably made me very difficult to work with on many occasions because...
In what way?
Well, nobody was touring South Africa in the 80s. The country was on full... The country was a pariah state. So all of a sudden, I get told, you're going to see Madonna tonight. Here's a ticket. And I look at the ticket. The ticket says £300. I'm like, what? And I'm sitting three rows from the front watching Madonna. And of course, I mean, obviously, all of her records were massive in South Africa, but I'd never seen her in concert. But then you start to really watch... And you go, oh my God, the amount of preparation that has gone into making this show what the show is. When you see that all of a sudden you go from nothing to working at the highest levels. And I remember saying to somebody, you know, I can't believe all the dancing, all the move, everything that the whole program, how it was all put together. I'd rather pay a few $100 and see something like that than pay $10 and see some guy trying to tune his guitar on stage and the amp blowing. And I had such immense respect because what I realized was the reason she was that big was because everything was just perfect. And it sort of made it complicated when I started to meet artists who wouldn't. I go, but Michael Bublé does everything. There's no issue from his management or the artist. Why do you have a problem with it?
I think it's interesting, actually, because... When you have like Michael Bublé or you have a Madonna or Josh Groban who are so successful, they work incredibly hard.
Yeah.
And I think you have to work incredibly hard as an artist to maintain your success. It's one thing becoming an A-list star. It's another thing maintaining that Correct. Level of stardom. A lot of people just go up and then come straight down.
Correct.
Right? So it's those ones that have the longevity that really are the true stars of their generation.
Absolutely right. When I look back at the artists that I love, or any artist you love, any artist that anybody does, people make fun of me because they know I'm such a crazy ABBA fan. And I really am. And the reason I'm such a crazy ABBA fan is the records. And I go, that's the kind of band I want, a band that can sell 400 million records. And the way I use it, you can use this with any of your favorite artists. When ABBA did Waterloo, it was the best thing they'd ever done. It literally was the best thing they'd ever done. That's why it was a hit. When they did SOS, it was the best thing they'd ever done. When they did Dancing Queen, it was the best thing they'd ever done. When they did The Winner Takes It All, it was like, what the hell is this? Number one all over the place. When they did Under Attack in 1982, was that the best thing they'd ever done? No. So no one knows the song, you know, except the hardcore fans. And you can apply that to any artist. And some artists have good, lots of art, most artists make good and bad records. But the thing is to keep on going
So as VP of International and then becoming VP of Creative, is that when you moved from the UK to LA?
Yes. So basically, the guy who was running Warner Records at the time said to me, you know, the center of music moves. Sometimes it's in London, sometimes it's in New York, sometimes it's in Berlin. It's back in Los Angeles and everyone's in LA. So I was like, okay. And the company was going through a huge transition. The kind of music they were selling, you have to change the roster. You can't be too reliant on one thing. You have to have enough pop, enough rock, enough black music, enough adult contemporary music. So we were sort of doing, creative is such a weird word, but it's really just creative marketing. And it's just looking for an idea and seeing how we can use that idea to get an opportunity to help an artist break.
Do you have a particular artist that you've worked with who is your favorite or has excited you most, or you don't want to say because you've loved too many?
No, I love too many. I'm very fortunate that I've been able to help both Josh Groban and Michael Bublé have very, very big careers and watch from the beginning, not from me showing up, you know, in London when Madonna's doing Confessions on a dance floor. It's very different to me going, this artist I love, I'm playing this record for everybody that I know. Everybody tells me it's amazing and we have to figure it out and do whatever we can and hustle and call everybody we know. And we're not going to stop until this guy is selling out arenas all over the world.
I watched David Foster's documentary on Netflix the other day,
yes.
And which was incredible. And the way that he basically discovered Michael and yeah. Josh and launch them.
Yeah.
I presume you must have really been a part of all of that and worked closely with David, and the whole experience must have been incredible.
I mean, it blew my mind. I'll say this to you. I love artists, but I really, really love record producers because I think it's the hardest thing in the world to be able to craft an amazing record that yeah. will change the world. And David Foster, Quincy Jones, Benny Anderson, my three favorite record producers of all time. I've got to meet them all. None of them have disappointed me. All of them have been completely forthcoming with any mad question I'd asked. I mean, I'll tell you what was shocking for a boy from South Africa. I think it was about 2004. I came to LA and went to see Bublé in the studio. And David had, I'm not sure if you ever went there with Catherine, but he had that little studio in that house in Malibu. It was like a sort of a standalone recording studio.
Do you mean
studio.
The one that the house up the hill?
Yes.
I went to that house, but Catherine recorded in a studio in Santa Monica, not there.
Right. So yes, at some point he sold the house. But I walked into the studio and there were gold discs from the one side to the other side, everything. And I had every one of those records, except for the Bodyguard soundtrack, which I'd never bought for some reason. I had, whether it was The Corrs or Buzz Skaggs or Chicago or Barbra Streisand or Natalie Cole, I had them all. I'd had every record. And, you know, that's what I couldn't, you know, when you sort of don't know when you're in South Africa, as I said to you, you know, I got the Josh Groban record. I flipped it over. It said produced by David Foster. You play it to people. And how hard can it be? Start marketing. I just couldn't believe it. And then you watch this man working.
Oh, he's a genius. He's a genius. But on top of that, he's so much fun.
Yeah.
I think I have to say that the time that I spent working with him when Catherine Jenkins was recording her album with him, when she was signed to Warner's, were probably six of the best weeks I've ever had in the business.
Yeah.
Because you just never knew from day to day what was going to happen with David. You really didn't.
Yeah.
And he's amazing. He was an inspiration, but every day was fun.
Yeah.
Every day was a lot of hard work. You worked hard, but it was fun.
You know, I'll tell you this. I became a huge Celine Dion fan.
Yeah.
Why? Because they said to me, David or Humberto or one of the guys that said to me, Celine, we know you're tired. We know you've had a long day. Please, please, can we try another take? And she'd be like, okay, take 47. Let's do it. And I have such respect for her because it's so hard to make these records perfect. That when you meet an artist who goes, yes, you know, I've gone somewhere and I've written 10 songs and they're all number one hits and my mom loves the record, you sort of don't know what to say to them. I mean, it's hilarious. I used to walk around the back where David used to have all his tapes and you'd see the artist he'd work with. It's a Barbra Streisand bad vocal. I'm like, what? It's just amazing. He's just an incredible, incredible musician.
Yeah, absolutely. Really. And I think when you've worked with someone like that, it has a lasting positive experience that will never leave you.
Yeah. You know, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I
If I'd come in and out of the music industry just for those 6 weeks, it would have been fine.
One of the greatest days of my life. It was so strange. Buble finally got asked to be on a Barbra Streisand record.
Right.
She made duets. And I'm sitting in the office and Michael's manager calls me. I'm like, where are you? And he was like, oh, we're in the soundstage at Warner Films. I'm like, what? Yeah, no, he's here with Streisand. They're doing the song. I'm like, what? I'm standing outside. Send somebody to get me. And I walked into the studio and there was Michael Bublé singing with Barbra Streisand.
Oh my goodness. What amazing.
And I'm like standing there frozen in the corner and she comes out and she looks at me and she goes, and who are you? And I go, my name's Dion Singer. And she goes, oh, what an interesting accent. I said, I'm from South Africa. And she goes, oh, Jim, he's from South Africa. We have lots of friends from South Africa. So we chat for a bit and she said to me, can I ask you something? I said, sure, ask me anything you like. She said, what is it like working with all of the artists? And I said to her, am I allowed to be honest? She said, no, please, I insist. I said, well, my problem is not the A artists. The A artists are, everybody works hard, the artists work hard, the label works hard, everyone in the company works hard, the management work hard. Everybody just wants to be the best of the best of the best. My problem are the C's. You think they're A's.
Oh, you're so right. Oh my God, you're so right.
And she said to me, how interesting. I agree. You're a very nice young man. I'm like, my mother is never going to believe this.
You know, I have to tell a little story, actually. When we were making that album with David, he called one evening and he said, hey, do you guys like Barbra Streisand? And I was like, yeah, we love Barbra Streisand. And, you know, it was sort of, I don't know, it was like 8 o'clock at night or something. And he said, you know what? It's her birthday. Do you want to come with me to her birthday party? And we were like, oh my God.
Oh, yes.
So we drove to Bel Air. She was having this party. A friend was hosting this party for her. And we walked in. And it was one of those Hollywood occasions that just only happen once in your life, basically. And we sort of walked in the door and Sidney Poitier was standing there.
Oh my God.
And Hugh Jackman and his wife and this one and that one. And Barbra was standing there holding one of her dogs, you know, sort of, you know, like...
like the record cover.
Right?
Yeah.
And Catherine had to sing Happy Birthday to her. And also an operatic aria with no rehearsal, no nothing. David just threw her in the deep end. But it was such an amazing night. It really, really was. And that was just David in a nutshell. Anything was possible.
Yeah.
Anything was possible.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, I don't talk to people about what I do because it just sounds so pretentiously poncy. And there's nothing worse than, oh, yeah, I've worked with this one. I've worked with that one. You know what? Just keep quiet. But I never forget every little thing. And it can be from that to a baby artist. I mean, I look at, for example, 21 Pilots, who are just incredible manager, incredible band. I remember going to their first concert, which was nobody knew what the hell to make of this. And they came to London and we went out for lunch and we had a conversation about international and how important it was. You know, I stole this line. There's a line in the West Wing. Democracy is decided by the people who show up. And I always stole the line. And I always said that the records and the tickets were sold by the artists who show up. And if you show up and you do the work, and I said, guys, we're going to call you. You're going to go to France. You're going to go to Germany. You're going to think it's the craziest TV show you've ever seen. You're going to think it's the craziest breakfast show. Just do it. We wouldn't take you anywhere that would hurt you or embarrass you. Just trust us, please. And the boys did.
Yeah.
And when you see them a couple of years later, you know, getting Grammys and
amazing,
selling out stadiums. And it's just, oh, it just makes my heart so happy.
So tell us about Over the Top Global.
Okay, so it was actually a bit of a joke. I didn't mean to have the...
That's your current company,
this
right?
This is my consultancy company. And what happened was when Madonna was coming toward the end of her relationship with Warner, when she was signed by Live Nation, we had to do a greatest hits record. And putting together a Madonna greatest hits record might be the most daunting thing in the world because you are, no matter what you do, you are going to get slaughtered on the internet by all of the crazy, passionate fans. Fortunately for me, there are a couple of people who helped me, some from some wonderful websites. You know, a lot of the amazing fans, I know what it's like to be a music fan. That's why any fan ever contacted me, I always tried to help them because I know what it was like trying to. Could you tell me when the next ABBA record is coming? Leon, it's 1988. They may have broken up. But We did so much research, and I worked on it for about 2 years. And when the record came out, I hadn't seen the final package. When it came out of the factory and I got the final sample, I opened up the booklet and it said, management, Guy Seri, publicity, Liz Rosenberg, Dion Singer, Over the Top. And I was like, oh, okay. So that was how I got. And, you know, when people have met, have you met that guy? Yeah, he's a little over the top. I'm like, yeah, exactly. That's where we want to take you. My dad had a saying, and I never understood it until I was much older, but he always used to say, you cannot be a little bit pregnant. You either are or you aren't. So if I love your band, I've got every record you've ever made. And if I don't like your band, I have nothing. You know, so I happen to like synthesizers. I've got a room full of them. I happen to like a certain kind. You know, I love Black Soul. I've got thousands and thousands of records. You know, so I always think that if you're going to do something, do it properly.
Absolutely. Otherwise,
don't waste your time.
What an amazing career you've had and still do have. Seriously. Amazing career, Dion. I'm so glad we found one another again.
Me too. Me
Sounds
too,
like Cara. A sort of romantic love story, that. But
you know,
so
it's so true. You know, the funny thing is this, is that, and this is what I try to say to people. I have great reverence for music. It saved my life. When you're a kid, all of us, you wake up one day and all of a sudden, you know, my dad had passed away when I was 13 years old and I threw myself into music. It literally saved my life. I have such reverence for it. It's so important. And it's one of the reasons I have challenges with people who don't respect. You know, they want to be famous. Or it's all about social media, or it's all about their pictures on Instagram or TikTok. It's about the music. If you get the music right, you know, I once had an artist say, I'm sure you've had this as well, but they only had one hit and they trashed their hit. And I went insane. And I said, hold on a second. That's not your song anymore. That's my song. I got married to that song. We drove 3,000 miles across the country so we could come and see your show. How dare you trash the song or say it's, you know, you're sick of it or you.
I hate it when artists do that.
I mean, you
I hate it when they do that.
It drives me crazy. Yeah. It's like you have a life. I mean, you know what this is like. You know lots of amazingly huge artists, and you also know 100,000 more that never made it. An artist once was upset because they didn't win a Grammy. And I said to the artist, hold on. You are one of 5 people in the world that has been nominated for this award. I mean, what are the chances of that? You know, maybe I look at it with different eyes because I'm from South Africa. I don't know. But this is why I have such faith in the future of music. There's just so much more to do. What does not change is that we've got to educate people. We've got to understand the history of the woman who taught Quincy Jones, Nadia Boulanger in Paris. She used to say, until you figure out what everyone's done with those 12 notes, you can't do anything else.
Yeah.
I'm always talking at music colleges and talking to young people because if they understand what has come before them, there is so much more to be done. And the one good thing about this pandemic, which I find interesting, and I know a lot of people are out of work, and I know 60% of the business comes from live, but there are a lot of artists that are using the time to write some amazing songs. I mean, the new Taylor Swift record is unbelievable.
I haven't listened to it yet, but I want to. I saw that it's like broken records. And
it's authentic. It's stripped back. You hear her voice.
She's so immensely talented. I watched her documentary as well.
And wasn't that a great documentary?
Oh, I thought she really came across totally differently to what I was expecting. And I had such huge respect for her.
Yeah, me too.
All of a sudden, I became a huge Taylor Swift fan. And I'd always respected her and liked her music. Yeah. But I was like, yeah, great. But on the back of that, getting to know her as a person and hearing her such strong beliefs and her feelings about human rights and all of those sorts of things, it was really special. And I've got huge admiration for her. Huge,
so
bigger than before.
Something had happened. 2 things I'll tell you about it. Michael's manager, Bruce Allen, who is my mentor and one of my best friends in the world, he called me and he said, kid, I'm flying down to LA. Meet me at Staples. We're going to see the Taylor Swift show. It's about 2-3 years ago. It blew my mind. We both stood at the mixing desk. And again, like with Madonna, with the amount of effort and how everybody had a bracelet and the bracelets would light up and how much work and effort had gone into it. And that documentary, you know what blew my mind with the documentary? And this is how you tell how you really get to the top. They show a scene where they're reading out, I think it was the Grammy nominations, and she doesn't get any nominations. And you know what she says? Well, going to have to make a better record. It's not about, oh, the marketing was terrible, the promoter didn't do a good job, the publicity person needs to be killed, and what's going on? And it's like, okay.
You're so right. That's such a good point.
It literally took my breath away. I rewound it and watched it twice.
Yeah. What I also loved about that documentary, in not such a profound way, was that I'm a big cat person and she loves cats.
Yeah.
And I think that shows a lot of soul.
Somebody, a friend of mine, always says to me, you can tell a lot about a person by the way they treat animals.
Oh, and she adores her cats.
It's great.
So that, that was very special. But on that note, we're coming to the end of this.
I'm sorry, we've taken so much time.
Please. Oh, God, no. It's been so lovely speaking to you and learning about your journey and hearing about the artists that you work with. And totally. I'm sure that the listeners have
loved
every minute.
It's been so thrilling to talk to you. But one thing I would say to anybody, and this is going to sound crazy what I'm about to tell you, but one of the reasons I was so excited about your podcast is that there is so much that is going to happen in the world, in the space of audio, in all kinds of immersive audio experiences. And because people can't go to shows, people are figuring out different things to do. And whether it be sort of spatial audio or a different way of experiencing music, it doesn't matter if it's the Calm app or if it's podcasts, there is so much to do. And when you look back in 10 years' time, it's going to be even 5 times bigger than it was. And globally, all over the world. You couldn't get anything in South Africa. You can now get everything by just a click of a mouse.
Yeah, times are changing. Well, hopefully, we'll be out of the COVID situation at some point in the foreseeable future. But in the meantime, stay safe and healthy.
Thanks for
everything. And thank you for being on the show. And thank you to all of our fabulous For Love and Music listeners for tuning in. And you will be hearing from me again very soon. Ciao for now.
Thank you for listening to For Love and Music with Tara Joseph. For more information, you can check out at For Love and Music Official on Instagram, at For Love and Music Official on Facebook, and also visit www.jamartistgroup.com/podcast.